Scotias Geheimnis – Von Ägypten über Dingle nach Schottland. Was verbindet eine ägyptische Prinzessin mit Irland und Schottland? Welche Spuren alter Mythen verbergen sich in der Landschaft rund um Dingle? Und warum könnten manche Geschichten weit mehr sein als bloße Legenden? In dieser Episode von Erlebnis Irland treffen wir den Schriftsteller, Folkloristen und Geschichtenerzähler Luke Eastwood. Seit vielen Jahren beschäftigt er sich mit irischer Mythologie, lokalen Überlieferungen, alten Kultplätzen und der Frage, wie viel historische Wahrheit in den Geschichten vergangener Generationen stecken könnte. Im Mittelpunkt unseres Gesprächs steht Scotia, jene sagenhafte Frau, die der Überlieferung zufolge aus Ägypten nach Irland kam und deren Name bis heute mit Schottland verbunden wird. Luke Eastwood erzählt, wie aus seiner Beschäftigung mit ihrem Grab bei Tralee eine jahrelange Recherche entstand und warum er Scotia mit der ägyptischen Prinzessin Meritaten in Verbindung bringt. Außerdem sprechen wir über außergewöhnliche Funde an der Dingle-Halbinsel, über Skellig Michael, die langsame Christianisierung Irlands, alte Göttinnen, heilige Brunnen und die Bedeutung mündlich überlieferter Geschichten. Eine Episode über Mythos und Geschichte, über offene Fragen und überraschende Verbindungen. Und über eine Landschaft, in der die Vergangenheit bis heute lebendig geblieben ist.
Hello, this is Felicitas from podcast Erlebnis Irland. I'm in Dingle today and I meet Luke Eastwood. He is a fascinating guest because he combines folklore, mythology, history, landscape studies in storytelling. And he is from Scotland, but he wanted to move to Ireland because...
Well, the main reason I came here was because of my partner at the time. I met, well, she's my ex-wife now, but we met in London in, was it 1990 or 91? And she's from Ireland. So eventually we ended up moving here. It was really, I suppose it often happens, you fall in love and somebody has to move somewhere. And so I ended up here, you know?
A friend of mine discovered his book Scotia, and she was very, very fond of it, and that's why I also read it. And then I contacted Luke because of that book, and we went to Scotia's grave a few days ago, and he wrote the story of Scotia. Can you tell us something about that book?
Well, that was a bit of a long process that led to that book, because I knew about her from the Irish legends. I collaborated with a guy called Gary Branigan on a book called Kerry Folk Tales, and in there was a story called The Pharaoh's Daughter, which is about her. He'd actually written that one. And then following on from that, I did another book called Dingle Folk Tales, when I wrote my own version of that story. And I ended up going to the grave a couple of times, and someone I know very well had designed an obelisk for that, and I met the stonemason who made that, called Billy Lean. And I used to have a job near in Tralee, and I used to drive past this obelisk and the road that leads to Scotty's grave every day, on the way to work, on the way home again as well. And this just seemed to keep coming up over and over. And I thought, well, maybe I should think about writing about this. So I did a research for like a long article. And then I thought, well, there's more and there's more and there's more. And I kept on finding more and more stuff. And I thought, well, maybe I need to go a bit further and actually make a book about this. Because there's a few people who've written about her before, particularly Lorraine Evans in the UK, the archaeologist, and an American guy called Ralph Ellis. But there were a lot of things that didn't really overlap with the Irish history and mythology, or with Spain, or Egypt. So there seemed to be very much like people that are interested in the mythology, and then there's people who are interested in the archaeology. and all the Egyptology stuff. But the two never seem to meet each other, because one is very academic and the other one is more like connected with folklore and spirituality and myth. So I figured, well, how do you get these two different versions of the past to meet each other? So I thought, well, maybe I can find where these two things actually overlap. And that's where the book came from, was really trying to see, is there any real evidence that links the myths with the reality of the actual past? And it was a big job. It took me 2 years to get that book finished. But it was a real challenge for me. It was really difficult because I'm not an Egyptologist, but I am a folklorist, and history is something I love, and I know how to do research. I did a dissertation at a university, so I understood the process of researching and finding things. But even so, it was difficult. It was very difficult because, especially the Spanish end of things, because I don't speak any Spanish. So I had to get some help and then get, academic papers translated into English and blah, blah, blah. So it was difficult, but I got there in the end, after a lot of hard work.
So how does an Egyptian princess come to Dingle?
Well, that's really the core of what the book is about. So, you start off with Akhenaten, because Mary Tate and his daughter, it seems, I'm not going to say 100%, but I would say 99.5% that Mary Tate is Scotia from the Irish legends and the Scottish legends. But so really, to understand the whole thing, you have to look at her father, Akhenaten, who Amenhotep IV, he was originally called. He changed his name and he started this religion called Artenism. And it was the first proper monotheistic religion, but he was so unpopular. The Egyptians really hated him for doing this. I can't think of a modern parallel, but and he must have seemed utterly disrespectful and insulting to people. Imagine someone invented a new religion that was worshipping Mickey Mouse, and he said, "You all have to do this now," and you had no choice. People would be really angry about that, wouldn't they? So that's like the closest parallel I could think of. So that led to a disaster for his whole family, and that is why Mary Tate ran away. She basically managed to escape, and we have evidence of an ancient letter written in, I think it was written in I think it was maybe Assyrian, or I forget now, it might have been in the Mesopotamian script, I think, to the Hittites asking for help, and various other evidence that I found in Spain and in Britain and Ireland, which would lead you to think that story is actually real. And then there's of course the grave as well, her actual grave. And then there's a lot of evidence of Egyptians in Britain as well, and up in parts of Ireland such as Tara up in County Meath. So it's not a complete picture, but it's like a detective story, really. When you add up all the little bits of evidence together, you start to think, there is a pattern here, there is a story to follow. And the two things do add up. I mean, I built on the work that other people have done, filled in the blanks and done my own research and visiting, obviously, the Scottish grave and the evidence that I found there myself, So I think there's a convincing argument. And I just hope that one day the Irish government will decide to excavate the place properly,
So it has hasn't been excavated. Just for our listeners, so if you take a look at Scotia's heritage, she is the supposed sister of the famous Tutankhamun, right?
Yeah, that's correct. She was his half-sister, a different mother, same father. So Tutankhamun's mother was a second wife called Kia, and Nefertiti was Mary Tatum's mother. She died. Nefertiti died. In fact, there were loads of tragedies of deaths in the family, really quite awful. And that's really what led to her leaving. Tutankhamun was a boy king. He wasn't anywhere close to being an adult. And then he married one of his sisters, and their children unfortunately died. The two babies are buried along with Tutankhamun. This sister survived and married the next two pharaohs, and then she died. So, but Tutankhamun, I think he's probably the most famous pharaoh ever, but I mean, he didn't have a very long reign, and he died in very strange, mysterious circumstances. He did try to return Egypt back to the old previous religion. He did begin that, but I think they just wanted to get rid of a whole dynasty and just erase them from history, which is effectively what they did. The whole city, capital city, was just abandoned and became hidden in the desert and was only rediscovered in the 1800s, you know. You can go visit it now for the first time since it was actually being used in the original time period, which is about 1300 BCE. You can go visit there now. You can get the train, I think, or go down the Nile and go to Amarna City and visit these places where Akhenaten and all his family would have been and lived and practiced their solar religion, you know, which is incredible. I really want to go there myself when I can, you know.
So she found out that it could have been dangerous to stay there, and therefore she tried to flee then.
Absolutely. Well, there's a lot of people believe that Tutankhamun, her brother, was murdered. There was a lot of deaths out of the six daughters. Looks like only two survived, really. That would have been Tutankhamun's wife, obviously, and then Mary Tatum herself. So they left. All the rest of his family all died. Everybody died. In fact, nobody survived, and there were no living ancestors left at all to carry on that dynasty. And that was the end of the 18th dynasty, and a new one, and then you've got the famous Ramesses is in the next dynasty. But I mean, she was the only survivor who got away, you know. She just had to run away, and she would have been killed for sure, I'd say, if she had stayed. They just absolutely wanted to erase them because, you know, the scale of the religion was, you know, like the equivalent of the Catholic Church. It was massive. You know, the whole of Egypt and their empire was following this religion.
They were connected all over.
Yeah, and then Akhenaten just basically killed it off just like that because he was pharaoh. He could just say, right, I'm changing everything. So the hatred against him was enormous. They had a massive economic recession as well. And then they had a lot of trouble with their empire, with revolts. So people, they saw that as a sign from the gods that Akhenaten was wrong, and they wanted to punish him, to kill him. And his grave was desecrated. His body, his sarcophagus was desecrated because, you know, there was a tremendous anger against his whole family. So I'm convinced 100% that she fled for her life. And we don't know much about how she left exactly, but we do know that there's remains of Egyptian ships found off the northern coast of Britain, and there's lots of artifacts from Egypt from that time period that have been found, not only in Britain but in Ireland as well. So you add it all up, the story is complicated. It's not a straightforward, easy story because you have going possibly to Greece. You don't know exactly who took her, the Hittites, Phoenicians, or Mycenaeans. And then she gets to Spain, and then to what was southern Scotland is now part of England, and from there to Ireland, and that's where she died in this huge battle. So it's a very long sort of trip over many years. She didn't just get in a boat and end up in Ireland the next day. It took years before she actually ended up in Ireland.
And then she chose Dingle or the Dingle Peninsula to get on board or on onto Ireland, and till Slieve Mountain, which has nicknamed the Bad Mountain, right? Or the
well, the Slieve Mish Mountains has got, you know, that's named from a later time period. There's a legend about this crazy wild woman who lived up there. But anyway, there's loads of legends around that mountain range. But what probably happened is, seemingly, if you get in a boat from Spain and just let it go where the current goes, you will end up off the coast of Dingle. If you didn't even steer it, the natural currents in the sea will bring you there. So I think they probably didn't necessarily intend to land in Dingle, but that's where they ended up. The sea brought them that way anyway. So these would have been the people called, what we call the Milesians, the Gaels, that she came with. Because, you know, her husband was one of the Gaels. And they invaded Ireland, the Milesians, and they had this huge series of battles with the Tuatha Dé Danann, who were already here and were ruling Ireland. So, I mean, she didn't spend very long in Ireland because she got killed in that big battle. So we don't actually know how long she was in Ireland. She could have been here for actually 1 week only, for all we know. But the reason she's so remembered is because she died in that battle, and her horse and herself are buried side by side there. And it's her and her descendants, her children and her children's children, that became, the people of Scotia, of her descent, and then they went to Scotland, and they are very proud to say that they're descended from Scotia, you know. So that's why Scotland is called Scotland, after her name, you know. After we don't know how she got that name, Scotia or Scotter, depending on which book you read, it's spelt with an I or no I. So nobody knows where that name comes from, but we do know that got carried on down her family line, and that her children, grandchildren, etc., became high kings and part of the elite ruling class. And then they migrated to Scotland and took over the whole west of Scotland. And then gradually the whole of Scotland became Irish-speaking, pretty much. They kind of merged with the Picts. And then, yeah, to this day, this country is named after her, right, even now. So she had a very big significance in history, which I'd bet you, if she'd been alive at the time in Egypt, you said you'll become famous and there'll be another country named after you in, 3,000 years, it will still be named after you. She probably would have been absolutely amazed, you know. So it is quite a shocking story when you think about someone coming all that way from Egypt and having the impact they had on Ireland and Scotland is incredible, really.
Especially if you have that grain of truth. And it could have been even more, you know. It's like a whole love of bread.
Well, the thing is, we have a bit of a lack of evidence. And that's partly because there's no excavation, and also partly because there have been some scandalous excavations done in Spain where they found ancient Egyptian stuff. And it didn't fit with the timeline that archaeologists wanted, so they just buried it all again or destroyed it. And that's happened a lot in various different areas of archaeology, where a new discovery that destroys the existing narrative is often hidden because they don't want to have to rewrite all the history books, you know, or to make themselves look bad. That you've been teaching a class for 30 years and then a new discovery proved that you were wrong. That's very embarrassing, isn't it? So there's always this resistance to new evidence that's going to change history. Like, you look at Göbekli Tepe, how long that took before it was accepted. I mean, he discovered that in 1960, that was 1964, they actually found that and started to work on it a little bit then. I mean, that's so long ago, but it's, you know, really in the last 10 years that place has become very famous. But I mean, that's a lifetime ago nearly, you know, that they actually found it.
And then sometimes you just don't believe what you see, and then you just think, okay, it can't be. And then if you put the puzzle pieces together, it makes sense, but at that time, maybe not.
Well, we tend to believe what we're taught in school, and you get a very simplified version of history in your school history lesson. But actually, as time passes and more things are discovered, you realize that those school text versions are often very inaccurate and are misleading, and the more evidence is being found all the time that is changing our understanding of history, you know.
It changes in Germany, so I teach my students, if I teach them, then if they find something different, it may change the history. So when I was a child, Christopher Columbus, he discovered America, okay? And then you have the Vikings, and you have even earlier evidence now, yeah, which is fine with me, but maybe not for everyone. But I know if you have evidence, it can change history, and that's the good thing about it, because if you have more evidence and you look for it, it may change a whole worldview. And it's not the first time, if you think about Renaissance or other things, that you have a cut and then you have to rearrange everything, which is fine. Keeps life a good way to structure something new.
Yeah, well, it's very inconvenient for some people, but to be honest, I would rather know the truth, no matter how inconvenient it happens to be. I think actual real history is about the truth, not about opinions or what is convenient for some people. I think there's a big desire to actually know the accurate version of what happened in the past. And I think that's been changed a lot by the internet, because before you had academics in a university and people didn't have the same access to all the information. Now it's a lot more open, and you know, people doing podcasts or doing alternative history, like Graham Hancock or somebody, you know, they're making people question what has been the official view, because they had a monopoly on everything before. And if you didn't have a degree or a professorship, then no one take you seriously. But now we realize that those people's view is very, very conservative and very slow changing, and they don't want change. So I think it's changed the whole way people look at history, which I think is very healthy. I mean, of course, there's some people with completely insane ideas about the past that don't make any sense, but there's other people who are actually seriously looking at real evidence and, you know, trying to piece together what has really happened in the past.
I think the most important thing is that you think for yourself and try to find the pieces of evidence that you think that fit together, so that you have the picture of things that you researched, and you have to take a look at your sources, so that you can look if this is a good source, if this is not a good source. And you also have to be careful with KI, artificial intelligence, because sometimes you get pictures and you have to question them too.
Yeah. Well, I don't ever use artificial intelligence for any of my own work. You know, I have a couple of memberships of these websites where you can look up any academic paper, and you get access to all these things as PDFs, and so you can get papers from all over the world. Okay, you could use AI to maybe go and find them all for you or whatever and tell you, but I prefer to do it myself and read the stuff myself. I have to trust in my own brain, because I do realize that I make mistakes, but AI also makes mistakes. So at least if I know I made a mistake myself, I can go fix it. But if I'm trusting AI and the AI is wrong, then I'm going to look like an idiot because I used AI stuff that's wrong, you know?
That's true. So if you take a look back at the local history here, what is the most surprising thing you've learned from collecting local stories?
Well, it's hard to say. There's so many interesting things that have happened. But one thing I found very interesting was like something that happened that was like so unlikely. There was what's called the Clusmore brooch, which an English guy on holiday found. And it's about the size of a 2-euro coin, no bigger than that. And it's solid gold with garnets and things. It was a bit like do you know the Tara brooch? What that looks, it looks a bit like that, but very tiny, tiny.
Yeah,
it's a circle with a clip through it and some stones on it. And it has some inscriptions, has a protection spell, I think, on the back. And I can't believe this guy actually found this, because what is the chances of that? He's just walking along on the beach and he sees a bit of something in the sunlight, and the gold reflected the light. And he could have just walked past, but he went and had a look and saw, what's that? Picked it up, and it's this medieval brooch. And now that you can go and buy a replica of that here in the jewelers in Dingle. There's a whole story behind that, which is in one of the books, actually, in the Dingle folk tales. And I went and, you know, talked to the jewelers and the museum curator about all that. But I mean, what is the chances of that happening? Is like almost zero, isn't it? But somebody found this brooch that belonged to someone, you know, over 1,000 years ago. They must have been, maybe they were out walking on the beach and they dropped it and they went to look for it, couldn't find it. 1,000 years later or more, someone else comes along on holiday and they find it. And they go, oh, wow, what's this? That is probably the most incredible thing, that just by pure chance that it got found again, you know?
Dingle is really rich in folklore. Which local story do you think deserves far more attention than others?
Well, they all deserve a lot of attention.
Which is your favorite one?
Well, I don't really know what I'd say favorite, but I mean, I suppose one of the funniest ones would be the story about the Dingle sturgeon. I don't know if you're aware of that guy. This guy, John Francis, when he was young, he was 19, they got this sturgeon fish, which was worth a fortune. Because that's where you get the caviar from, isn't it? From the sturgeon. Anyway, he ended up throwing it back in the sea, and it was a mistake. And everyone was like, oh my God, why did you do that? Because like, it was worth like £100 or something back in the 60s, which is like thousands today, whatever, probably worth 1,000 or more. Anyway, they caught another one, which ended up being going to the Queen of England. It ended up in Buckingham Palace, and she probably ate it, or some of her family. But there's a whole play about that, which is very, very funny, a very funny comedy play. And it's just become like a really famous story, but this guy just made an embarrassing mistake and it's become a legend, you know?
They're the best ones, aren't they?
Yeah, so it is kind of funny. And I met him and I interviewed him for the Dingle Folk Tales book. He's a really lovely guy, you know? And yeah, he's a good sense of humour. In fact, when the play was on here in Dingle, he went to the same performance I went to. And they made him get up at the end and say, there's the guy over there, please get up. And he got up and everyone gave him a big round of applause and everything. The play was basically, wouldn't have never happened if it wasn't for him, you know? So it was funny, very funny, you know?
So why do you think such places as Dingle seem especially rich in myths and legends?
Well, I think because Dingle's kind of isolated, it's preserved a lot more things than you might find in other parts of Ireland. Because it's hard to get to. And I mean, the whole peninsula is full of interesting stuff. You could barely walk a kilometre and you'll bump into some ancient thing, you know? But I mean, the whole of Ireland was like that. But parts of it have got, you know, because of farming and building cities and more stuff and more houses and changes in modern life, a lot of that's gone in some parts. But Dingle's kind of retained most of that. And then, of course, from the 60s onwards, people realized that there was a big market for tourism here. It was really that film, Orion's Daughter, that changed that. Before that, no one ever came here as a tourist. No, virtually nobody, very few people. But that all changed after Orion's Daughter, and they realized that this was something that was a bit special. And the fact that it, a lot of these things had been preserved for intact. And then you just got this whole massive surge in tourism as a result. And then again, more after Star Wars was filmed here as well, a lot of it. So that comes another massive boost again to the tourism here. And I mean, there's the whole country is amazing. There's every county's got some amazing stuff. But I guess that film, Star Wars, plus Ryan's Daughter, and I think Far and Away was filmed here. Those three films really kind of made Dingle internationally famous. So that's why I guess everyone wants to come here. But I would suggest people, like, yeah, come to Dingle, but, you know, don't forget about the rest of the country as well, because there's some amazing stuff all over the whole 32 counties, which is just quite mind-blowing, some of it. Although I must say, Skellig Michael, just off the Dingle coast, is probably the most incredible place I've ever visited. It's just absolutely mind-blowing.
It's in the middle of nowhere, and you have to take a boat to get there. Yeah. And then, if you're lucky, you can go on top and go those, I think, 300-something steps up there.
Yeah, it's a lot of steps, and it's tough. It's a tough trip if you're not got good sea legs. And I was sick on the way there. And I was coming back, and I was only like 5 minutes from the harbour, and I got sick again. And I was just so ill. I was just like, I couldn't even eat anything for ages. I was hungry, but I just felt so bad. But it was worth it. It was worth being sick twice just to go up and see everything up there. It's incredible. It really is amazing. And you know, if you were super rich, I think there's a helicopter pad. but I mean, most people can't afford to get a helicopter over there.
Me neither.
but I would recommend it. There's two places you can go from Dingle. You can go from Port McGee as well. The Port McGee is where we went for, because it's much shorter trip. Oh, thank God. I'm so glad I didn't take the long trip, because I would have been sick even more times probably. But it was just really bad, choppy waters, and I kept getting hit in the face with seawater, and I swallowed some, and then that's when I started to feel really unwell from all the salt. But it was brilliant though. We got, I think, about 4 hours on the island. It was amazing, and the weather changed to, you know, good weather. It was beautiful sunshine, so it was really, really nice. But I mean, you know, it was a tough trip. I got totally drenched and sick, but I still think it was worth it, though.
I was once with Christoph there before we had the kids, and I just remember I'm very afraid of heights, but I had to get up, and I had to get up to the top, but I needed help downwards with Christoph, so he helped me. So I thought, okay, that's the husband for life.
I don't like heights either. I found it tough. There's a certain bit where you have a big straight ledge, and if you look down, it's like about 400 feet or more, and you're like, oh my God, it was awful. But I mean, I overcame my fear of heights, and you just keep in close to the stones, and just don't look down is the best thing. If you're scared of heights, you can do it. Just take your time and go slowly is, I suppose, the most important thing. Because there's no safety rails, there's no banisters, nothing like that. So, I would say if you like have a really terrible, terrible balance, maybe it's not the best place to go to.
I think so. I think if you have kids, they only allowed on top of the island if they're 12 years and older. So you should inform yourself before if you have kids, if you want to visit the Skelligs, but it's really worth it. And you have to get up early because there are only about 180 people allowed once a day, and only on sunny days they go there, I think.
Yeah, I was very lucky when I went, because it was just after COVID, so they cancelled everything and you had to rebook. So I was lucky I got exactly what I wanted. And it was, yeah, pretty early in the morning. It wasn't super early. But yeah, there are limits because it's a UNESCO heritage site. So they have to be very careful not to overload it with too many people. And, you know, they're very serious about ensuring it doesn't get damaged, you know. And like, you know, I think if you drop litter there, you'll probably be, you know, punished for like 10 years in prison or something. I'm only messing about that. Yeah, but like, you know, they're very, very keen to look after it and keep it pristine and preserved as it is now, you know.
Are there special stories about Skelligs or rather not?
Well, yeah, there are. There's actually, I won't go into too much detail, but there was one story which is to do with like Scotia and the Malaysians that one on the trip to Dingle, one of the princes of the party died and he was buried there. And that's about, if the timing is correct, that'll be 1300 and something BCE. So about 2,300 years ago, 3,300 years ago at least.
Okay, that's quite a lot of time then. And a little bit time between the first monks that went there, so...
Well, I believe the place was built before the monks, and the monks inherited what was built by the Druids, and they just added to it, I think. That's my belief, and that's very difficult to prove. I think there is some evidence to prove that, but, you know, it's very much something that academics would argue. Some might agree with me, others would be telling me, oh, you're talking nonsense, you don't know what you're on about. But, I mean, very much the official view is to date everything in the Christian period if possible, whereas as we're seeing now that a lot of things are older than we thought they were. And I think Skellig Michael is one of those cases.
I think so too, because it's in the middle of the sea, you have a good view around the area, so if you would like to stay there, you have a four, it's an ideal place, especially at the beginning. And if you have people on the seashore connected with them, for example via light, then it may be a very mighty point to rule.
Well, I don't think it was ever a place that people lived before the monks went. Okay. I think it was a religious center for ritual and to do with the afterlife. And I don't think people lived there all the time. It was only the monks that decided to do that. Okay. I think, you know, it doesn't seem a sensible place to live. To go there for some religious purpose... Yes, that makes perfect sense. You go there, maybe you stay there a couple of days, you do what you're doing, and then you go back to the mainland. But try to live there all the time, that's kind of a bit crazy, really, you know?
So you mean it's like a burial place then, or?
Well, I think more like a religious community, really, a religious center. And, you know, a lot of the religious places of Christian Ireland were already in use before. Like Glendalough in Wicklow was already a centre for religion in the pagan period. And so many of these places have been reused and turned Christian. But because, you know, you can't just arrive somewhere overnight and make everyone change. Ireland actually took about 400 years to convert from pagan to Catholic. They don't tell you that in the OPW or government website. They're not going to tell you that, but that is the truth. There is very strong evidence of archaeology to prove that there were still pagans alive being buried in a pagan fashion in 800 AD, you know? So this idea that Patrick showed up and suddenly everyone became Catholic, that's all rubbish, you know? So it was a long process. And they took the old sites And, you know, somewhere like Croke Patrick, that was already a holy mountain before. It didn't suddenly become a holy place just because Patrick showed up. It was, they changed it. They changed the nature of the use of it to fit with the new Christian ideas. It was already a holy place that people made pilgrimages to for who knows, thousands of years possibly. To see, because so much of it is not written down, you only have the oral traditions or what is written down by the monks later on. So some of it is quite hard to know exactly what happened. But then the more archaeology that's done, you start to get more information that fills in a lot of the blank spaces, you know? Like this place called Clochter up in Mead, the excavations they did in 2014 there are really quite amazing and revealed a lot about that place and that it was a lot older than people thought, you know?
It's normal that you have like those religious places and then you get another religion coming and taking the structures that are already there to put their structure on it, because then it's easier to get into different communities and different things. It's like they used the church in order to have the bishops, because they had the system before, so the Romans did that, and other religions or other societies did that too. So the Catholic religion has a good way of taking old structures and put new ones on there.
Yeah, well, it makes a lot of sense in terms of time and economics, doesn't it? Why go and build a completely brand new thing when you can repurpose something that someone else already made? You know, that saves a lot of time and energy, doesn't it? It makes perfect sense, you know? You know, why would you? I mean, of course, they did build new places too, but they repurposed all the existing religious structure that was in Ireland already.
Yeah, because it was already sacred, and then you could just take another there, and for the people that were still pagan, they could still use that part, but with a different god in that case.
Yeah, and a lot of the practices got just changed on the surface area, a surface level, I mean, to become Christianized. Like all this going round clockwise around sacred sites, around wells, and all that kind of thing. That's not really Christian. And I mean, the wells and grottos, that's not really a Catholic thing. That's something that has got been adapted to become Catholic practice in Ireland. It was already happening before. They just changed the meaning of things. And you have things to do. Instead of the three realms of the pagan world, you have the three elements of the Holy Trinity. And you just adapt it, the model, and you can still use the same practices and the same sites, but you just change the religious meaning of it, and there you go. You don't have to reinvent the wheel. You just change things a little bit, you know.
It's just kind of the same, like the Egyptian mother goddess that became the same as Mother Mary. So you have the same statues, but they changed the name.
Yeah, it's exactly how it works. Yeah, like Danu would be the mother goddess here. There's a place in called Shrone, and just there is this ancient city of the Red Claw, and it's right below the Paps of Anu. Now you have statues in this very ancient fort, ring fort, to Mary. But back in the day, there may have been a statue of Danu, who will probably look almost exactly the same. It's like an update, really. They updated from the old goddess to the mother of God instead, you know.
But they got the same jobs, so that's what was kept. The name was different, but they get the same job.
Yeah, exactly. And when you look at Ireland's Catholic faith, Mary is really very, very important in Irish Catholicism, maybe more so than many other countries, because you had this goddess worship in Ireland that goes back thousands and thousands of years. And, you know, you just can't just stamp that out straight away. That, okay, how are we going to deal with this? Okay, we'll make Jesus' mother into a replacement for all these goddesses. So instead of many goddesses, you just have one who is like a universal goddess for for the all Christians, they just worship Mary instead, you know.
But you find it more or less on like sources where you have water sources, holy wells, and you find it where you have the earth goddess. So it's kind of a mixture out of both. So earth and water mixed together, and there you find the Mary statues.
Yeah, that's very common. Yeah, it's very often the case. But I mean, you think people that were used to going to sacred sites like a well or some particular feature in the land like the Paps of Anu, they're going to keep wanting to go there. So you just have to change the story a little bit, and then you know, it's acceptable to become Christian. And then eventually people forgot about the pagan element of it, and they just carried on doing what they'd always done, but it's become part of the Christian faith, you know. And now I suppose people are more and more interested in the pre-Christian Ireland. And what that was actually about. I mean, a lot of guesswork's involved in that. I mean, people are trying to put it all together from the folklore and from the archaeology and from the Irish texts that have been translated into modern Irish or into English or whatever. In fact, there's a German scholar called Kuno Meyer who did a lot of work of translating the Irish texts. You know, it was amazing, really, because he didn't speak Irish. Originally, obviously, he was German, but he learned Old Irish and actually did a lot of really important translations into German and English. So, but I mean, that process is still ongoing. There's still loads and loads of texts in Irish that have not been translated into modern languages. So hopefully one day that will happen, but it all costs money, unfortunately. So funding for that is kind of important, that for that to happen, the money has to come from either the government or from private sources of fundraising, you know.
So if you go back to folklore, you have quite a lot of folklore around here, and you also published or helped publish a book about fairies, right? Mm-hmm. About Irish fairies of the Flower Realm, with your colleague Eleanor Danan and Fionnuala O'Gorman.
O'Gorman, yeah.
How did it come that you published a fairy book?
Well, the original pictures had been done as a series of cards and posters. And so I had the idea, why not turn this into an actual book? So I helped with a lot of the research for, you know, the information on the flowers and the folklore. And then we put it all together, and I did the graphic design for this. And, you know, it was just a really nice way of actually putting the beautiful illustrations together with some, you know, history and folklore related to these plants, because these are all native plants in this book, which some of which you only find in Ireland and nowhere else, you know. So yeah, it was a fun project, but you know, I think as well as being fun, it does actually preserve a lot of the oral folklore and information that's being passed down through generations. So, I mean, we live in an age now where I suppose you have to write things down, because it could get lost. It could get lost because, you know, there's some old person who's the last one that knows these stories. If they don't write it down before he could teach it to some young person, it's gone forever.
What you write stays.
Yeah. Well, it's really sad that it's like that there's less people interested in, like, the bardic arts or mythology or recording folklore.
Do you think so? I think they're more than now.
Well, what I mean by that is someone who's prepared to sit down with some old guy and learn all these things, you know, and memorize them all. That's a lot of work. Say, you've got to sit there and you've got to listen to this story 15 times until you remember it exactly. How many people will have the patience to do that?
None.
Not many people, would they? They want to read it in a book or see a video about it or listen to it on the radio. They're not. Imagine you got to do that. It takes you 15 listens to remember the whole story. And then it's as well, I've got another 100 stories as well. Do you want to hear them? How much time has people got? I mean, back in the day, a lot of the ancient druids, the bards, they have to learn a minimum of 350 stories exactly. Roughly, they have to learn it 100% exactly right. Do you imagine how much concentration and energy and mental effort and time that took to, say, memorize exactly 350 stories? That's like a huge, huge intellectual effort, you know? So, I mean, most people aren't going to be able to do that. Even if they wanted to, not everyone has the time and to energy to put into doing that.
Mythen erzählen nicht immer, was genau geschehen ist. Aber sie bewahren Erinnerungen, Bilder und Erfahrungen, die über viele Generationen weitergegeben wurden. Das Gespräch mit Luke Eastwood zeigt, wie eng Landschaft, Geschichte und Erzähltradition in Irland miteinander verbunden sind. Ob Scotia tatsächlich eine ägyptische Prinzessin war, bleibt eine offene und kontrovers diskutierte Frage. Doch gerade die Suche nach möglichen Spuren macht deutlich, wie faszinierend die Verbindung von Archäologie, Folklore und lokaler Überlieferung sein kann. Vielleicht liegt die besondere Kraft irischer Geschichten genau darin. Sie geben keine einfachen Antworten. Sie laden uns dazu ein, genauer hinzusehen, Fragen zu stellen und die bekannten Vorstellungen von Vergangenheit immer wieder neu zu überprüfen. Vielen Dank, dass ihr uns auf dieser Reise durch die Mythen und Geschichten der Dingle-Halbinsel begleitet habt. Wenn euch diese Episode gefallen hat, abonniert Erlebnis Irland und teilt den Podcast gerne mit allen, die sich für Irland, seine Landschaften und seine außergewöhnlichen Geschichten begeistern. Bis zur nächsten Folge von Erlebnis Irland.